I mean, we make a kind of list of all the modifications and whatever, but actually we didn't start to make something dynamics. And this subject, on the contrary, is quite dynamic, since what we see here is how the chromatin is organized during development, okay, and how it is maintained. This is a very important problem in biology, and actually, it's in general is the epigenomics, okay? So what happens not in the sequence of DNA, but what happens to the use of the DNA sequences. So we start with lesson 2.1, that is we study actually PTM and other chromatin features distribution throughout the genome. So how they are distributed in cells and how we can study them. And then we go through the mitotical inheritance of chromatin states. Actually, this is the subject of the textbook you have, of Campos. I think it's quite clear, it's quite well done. Of course, as usual, when you make a review that is written by an author that spent all his life studying the problem, there are many, many things that are supposed to know. But if you can go through quietly, you can actually use it very well. Okay, so we know what we knew from, let's say, pre-genomic studies was that, of course, what we saw last week, so that we have widely repressive modifications that in general are these ones, K9me3, which is the one I told you that is peripheral, mostly peripheral in the nuclear, in the nucleus. Then we have H3, K27me3, that is the more dynamic in the sense that you found it also in the center of the nucleus and is probably associated to the genes that are being repressed. Okay. And then we have cytosine hypermethylation in what we call CpG island. We will see in a minute what it means. And then we have other kind of marks that are widely active, so they actually associated with an active state of chromatin, that are H3, K4, Me3, Me1, Me2, Me3, because actually this is much more variable in some sense, okay? So mono, di, and trimethylation. And this is the contrary of this one, of course, so acetylation to K27, and also this other one, H3, K36, Me3. And finally, general histone hyperacetylation, as you know, that is associated with active regions. Okay, so this is a kind of old concept, okay? Started to study, the scientists started to see this kind of distribution in 20 years ago, something like this, okay? But now the story is that, of course, we have now an idea that is genome-wide, and this because when this is the same slide we presented after the Human Genome Project last week, and this is the second chapter, this is functional genomics. So when the sequence of the human genome was ready in 2003, more or less, people started projects trying to map all the possible functional activity of the genomes. Okay, so the declared goal of these projects was to give a meaning to every single nucleotide of the genome. To say, this is a gene, this one is a promoter, this one is a non-coding RNA, this one, so try to describe it. So this kind of very big project that involved many, many, many laboratories around the world, and they took epigenomics as a point. So what we said already, don't make me repeating, you know very well, comprising protein DNA mapping, so transcription factor interacting with different parts of the genome, and then finally what we call transcriptomics, that means to describe in every cell type which are the parts of the genome that are transcribed, either coding and non-coding. Okay, so this is the story. And the most famous of this project is what is called ENCODE. ENCODE stands for Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, and it involved something like 25 laboratories around the world, and what they did was to try to study everything. So they have a very nice site, website, that is this one. And if you can spend a little moment to go through, there is explanation of everything. Methods, the idea, results, whatever. And we probably make a quick tour today just to see the number of experiments that they run. It's quite impressive. So this is just to say what they did. Is this kind of picture is taken from the website, right? And they actually depict chromosome, chromatin, and then a number of things that are exactly the objects they studied. Okay, so they studied, for example, they used these three technologies here, DNA-SPHERE, ATAC-seq, to study the hypersensitive sites, you remember from last week. So the sites that are actually open, okay, all the, through the genome. Or they try to use this chip, seq, that you know already, to describe all the proteins that interact with DNA and where for each of them, okay? Then the methylation, of course, this is methylation. And the histone modification, of course, this is acetyl, this is methyl, of course. Then using this kind of technologies here, so WGBS, RRBS, methylara, and so on, to describe all the regions that are DNA methylated in the DNA. Of course, transcription, RNA-seq, and proteins which interacts with RNA. So this is made with these two kind of technologies here, CRIP-seq and RIP-seq, and whatever. And then please note that, of course, the first one. This is long-range interaction. So the all the parts of the genome that interact together, but on the long range scale. And this is used with different technologies here that we will go through maybe later on. Please note that in the difference of the DNA sequence project that we talked about, okay, in that case, of course, we have mostly the same genome in all our cells, okay? So usually you take individuals, and since you cannot take out a small piece of tissue, organ, whatever, usually you take blood to make this kind of sequence, and then you make sequence of different individuals, okay? And this is the database of DNA, of genomes, okay? But when you look at this, all these kind of stories, this is strongly dependent on cell types. I mean, transcription, of course, is intuitive, but also all the chromatin features, they are strongly dependent on cell types. They are different from cell types. So one of the major points here is that you have to take many, 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 many different cell types. And this is a difficulty, because, of course, especially studying human, you cannot take cells from the adult. Okay, you have just to rely on cell lines. And as you know, most of the cell lines available for researchers are not normal. They are either immortalized or oncogenic. I mean, they are tumors. Okay. You can take few primary cells from few tissues. Okay, blood, for example, but also skin or whatever. But it's very difficult to have primary samples. This is completely different from the animal. So, for example, a project that ran in parallel with ENCODE that is called Phantom, that means the functional anatomy of the mouse, of course, they have the possibility to go through the tissues. It's different. And also from the different stages of development, of course. So let me just go to the, a little moment to the side, just to show you that. I hope it works. consento. Come si fa già che non mi ricordo mai? Sto fuori qui. This is a website? No. Perché non funziona sto fare? Boh, non lo so, non funziona. Ci andiamo così, non è un problema. Ok. It's very easy to find, no problem. So, okay. Just this is the site. I just want to show you the they worked on human, mouse, worm, and fly, but especially on human. Okay. And this is the comparison with other projects. As you can see here, this is ENCODE, the blue one. And this is the other project that you will learn in the future, like Roadmap and Modern and whatever. And these are the comparison of the number of experiments they did. Okay, so ENCODE actually was the most important of those. And this is the biosample type. As you can see, out of these 14,600 experiments they did, there is mostly of them are cell lines. It's the blue section here. And then this is tissue, the red one. Okay, and this is all organism, of course, not referring to human, and so on. Okay, and this is just the assay categories. And then there is something impressive, then we go back to the lesson, that is the data matrix. Data matrix is really impressive because it shows you, can you see that? A little bit. I see very well on the screen. Okay. It's difficult to see, but what you see here is, okay, this is cell line, okay? And this is tissue, this is whole organism, this is primary cells, and blah, blah. And these are the different experiments. This is ChIP-seq, okay? So ChIP-seq using either transcription factors or modification to histones, okay? And if you see the number here, it is 669. So they have 669 ChIP-seq experiments only on this K562 that is a fibroblast. Okay? Then you have the list, and then you see here C254 more. So they have something like 260 cell lines listed over there in which they run all these kind of experiments. This is a matrix since some of them lack some kind of experiment. This is ChIP-seq, this is DNA-seq, this is poly-A RNA-seq, and blah, blah, blah. But since you cannot see there, I suggest you to go to the site 10 minutes just to realize what you have. This is particularly important. I spend a little additional minute on it because it's particularly important because modern biology, most of the data that you are looking for are already there. I mean, you are thinking about what is, I don't know if albumin is expressed in this cell line. No need to make experiment in the what we call the wet lab. You go to the dry lab, that is this one, look for the RNA expression in that cell that you are looking for and see whether the albumin is expressed. So you make in silico biology much more. We have an enormous amount of data there. Okay. So actually, I see that in the lab, people, they use a lot this kind of approach. So whenever you ask a question, first of all, go to ENCODE, look if the data are already there, and then maybe you have to run some wet experiment, additional wet experiment, and most of the data are there already. So let me go back to the lesson. We will spend some time on it. Okay, so this is the lesson. Yes. So let me see what this is just the explanation of each of the categories you saw before, and it's just the purpose of each of the experiments, okay? And actually this project started before the NGS technology appeared, because it started in more or less in 2002-2003. And actually the NGS technology appeared in 2006-07, something like this. Okay, so they started with using DNA microarrays. All of you know what DNA microarrays are? Yes? Yes or not? Who say no? I don't know. You all know. Okay, very good. Actually, DNA microarrays, as you know, there are two types. One is the so-called expression microarrays, in which the probes correspond to RNA. Okay? Or people here, they use it what is called pilot microarrays, in which the probes actually cover all the genome. So you can describe chip analysis, whatever. Okay? But anyway, you have a background help if you don't remember the microarray technology. Good. So, first of all, accessibility. Last week we studied the DNA's hypersensitive assay in single locus. Okay, of course this is on genome-wide. Okay, and we have essentially three kinds of technologies: this DNA-seq, this FAIR-seq, and this ATAC-seq. Okay, this is DNA's. No explanation needed, because you know. This FAIR means formaldehyde-assisted isolation of regulatory elements, and this ATAC means assay for transposers accessible chromatin. Okay, all these assays are coupled to NGS, of course, but also in the first years of ENCODE they used microarrays. Okay, so that's the story. So DNA-seq is quite easy to imagine. You may have locations in the genome in which there is no nucleosome, like here, because you have a protein, for example, that keeps the nucleosome around, and then this will be an accessible site for DNAs. Okay, so in this kind of assay, you just cut the chromatin by DNase 1, then you fragment the as usual with sonication. Okay. And then, at this point, you have the fragments that, of course, they correspond to the site where the DNA is cut, okay? So you have the linker and whatever, and then you make sequence by NGS, and so this fragment here was adjacent to the DNA's one cut. Okay. So essentially, you map all the sequences that were close to the cut of DNAs. Okay. This is the story for DNA-seq. Then the FAIR-seq technologies is a little different, because actually it only makes reasoning about the content of protein. I mean the content that the DNA is bound to protein. Okay, so whenever you have a fragment in which you have many protein bound to the DNA, you will have essentially no DNA free, okay, because it's bound to protein. If you have open chromatin, you have fragments in which the DNA exists without protein attached to it. Okay, so it's free DNA. Now we have a very stupid basic technology to separate the free DNA from protein-bound DNA, that is phenyl chloroform extraction. If you make a phenyl chloroform extraction of this mix, you will have in the surnatant, you will have free DNA. And in the final phase, in the organic phase, will be protein-bound DNA. Okay? So you just make a separation of DNA that is almost free of proteins versus DNA that is still occupied by proteins. Of course, you have to make a cross-link at the very beginning. So you treat with formaldehyde, exactly as we did for ChIP-seq. Okay? So you cross-link protein and DNA. And then you make extraction. Then you take the free DNA and sequence. So all the sequence that you find there will be the accessible region of the genome. Okay? So this is the second technology. And the third technology is a little more complicated, but it is very smart, say. As a definition of accessibility means that you can access to the DNA sequence, right? Exactly as in the DNA's case, okay? So people invented a different story. Do you remember the transposons we talked about? Transposons move in the DNA by using transposases that are enzymes that home the DNA in another place. So people devised, biotechnologists devised a smart story. So they developed a transposase complex, that is this green story here, that is already bound to sequencing linker. You remember that for making NGS, you have to put linkers from one side and another linker from the other side to make PCR and libraries, okay? So this transposase is already bound to sequencing linker. Okay? You add this protein complex to your chromatin. Now, wherever you have closed chromatin, the transposase cannot access, of course. While whenever you have open chromatin, the transposase that is here, can you see it? This one, this guy, will go to the DNA and insert the two linkers. Okay? So you have, at this point, you will have fragments that are with the linkers. Okay? Then you extract the DNA and you have already fragments that are linked. So they are already the adapters. And you make the library over it, and then sequence. So this is a very smart technology to assay for the sequencing, for the accessible regions of the genome. It has been presented in, you can see very recently, in 2013, and now is probably the most widely used technology for it. It has almost replaced DNA's assay because it's much more specific than the other one. Okay, so as you remember, whenever we make this kind of sequencing, it's quite different to have a sequence of a genome. Genome, you remember, you have a description of all the reference genome. In this case, you have peaks, of course. So you have clusters of sequencing in the small region that you have identified, like ChIP-seq or DNA-seq or whatever. Okay, so you get peaks, and you have this kind of a representation that you saw already, but just to try to make the... You will see so many of those in all the course that we have to really to learn it very well what it is. Okay, so the depiction is that you have a map of the genome, okay, here to here. This is an example that takes chromosome 19 and only this small region that is marked here in red. Okay, so this small region, as you can see, this is the scale map, the map scale, that is 50 kilobytes from here to here. So actually you have something, these are the coordinates. Okay, so you see 36,150,000, 200, and 250. So it takes something like 100 kilobases from here to here, okay? Just to reorient the story. And then what we have here on the left is the number of reads, of course normalized, because as you can see here you have a 1 zero, so it means that you have normalized it on the total, but means actually the number of reads for each small piece of sequence here, okay? So what you see here is just a comparison of the technologies that we have just seen in the explanation. So here is the result that people did with the ATAC-seq on 50,000 cells. And as you can see, you can scale it down until 500 cells, until really a tiny amount of cells for this kind of analysis. Okay, and this is DNA's, the usual DNA's seq analysis, the ferroseq analysis. And as you can see, you have most correspondence on the three methods. The peaks that you see here are almost the same. Okay, of course, you have very little peaks here because this is a few cells. Okay, but the highest peaks are visible also in this case. Okay. So these are the location of the most accessible sites in the genome, and usually the most accessible sites in the genome are enhancers. Okay, but we will learn in the next week that actually enhancers are programmed very early in the life of a cell, so they actually stay as a hypersensitive site around. So in the down here you see the genes that are present in this piece of the chromosome. There are many genes. This is a quite dense region of the chromosome. Okay, good. Wait, can go move further. So histone PTMs were studied, of course, by ChIP-seq or chip-on-chip. That means, you know, that microarrays were also named chip, like the chip of electronics. So sometimes you find this term chip on chip, means chromatin immunoprecipitation, then microarrays. Okay, so just to tell you that sometimes you can ask why not all the modification to histone have been studied, or why not all the transcription factors have been studied by ENCODE. The problem is that not all the available antibodies are good for chromatin immunoprecipitation. This is probably the most important problem in CHIP. CHIP is very easy to run. I mean, every laboratory that has normal, basic molecular biology technology can do it. It's really not difficult. Main problem is the antibody. Why? Because, of course, as you will probably you know, and you will learn better in the next lessons, transcription factor as well as histones and whatever, they are part of big protein complexes. So most of the surfaces of a protein are actually occupied by other proteins. So it's quite difficult to find an epitope available for antibody. Okay, especially because you fix them, as you remember. So you make formaldehyde fixing as a first step. So all these big complexes are fixed. No way to reach them. Okay. So what we do very often in the lab is to mix two or three different antibodies with the hope that at least one of those will pick up my factor. Okay. Anyway, that's just a comment. And so when you make a ChIP-seq experiment, you make immunoprecipitation of you have learned already, and then you take the fragments that are bound to the factors by immunoprecipitation, and then you make a library and sequencing, okay, and then you have alignments. So usually it's a software. You have not to make millions of alignments yourself, okay. So the software actually aligns all these guys there to the reference genome, and then there is what we call the peak calling, that I hope that the bioinformatics will learn how to do, is just to distinguish noise from real peaks of a factor bound to the DNA. Okay, and then at this point you can of course make the usual graphs and also look for example, for special sequences that are frequently found in your fragments, that is the analysis and visualization of the factor. Okay. Good. So let's just see one of the first papers that was published on this kind of analysis of PTMs, just to see what is the workflow and the kind of results that you can get it. Okay? Also because it will illustrate some of the specific position of PTMs. Okay, this is the care is that actually they used the very first Illumina version that was, as you remember, making very short reads. So they have some difficulties in mapping this short read. But anyway, it was a good story. So this is the paper. And it was published on Cell, that is one of the most important journals, as you know. Not as a paper, but as a resource. This is typical of the journal Cell, that publishes sometimes this kind of articles that is not a scientific history, it's just an analysis of something, and they present the data, and that's it. So this was an analysis of, as you can see here, distribution of 20 histone, lysine, and arginine methylations, as well as histone variants H2A.Z, RNA polymerase 2, and the insulator binding protein CTCF across the human genome, okay? And so they had something like 24 or something results. And this was done on primary human CD4 plus T cells. Of course, this is the one of the few cell types that you can take from a human being. Of course, it's taken for blood, so no problem. And you can also purify. This is important because whenever you, if you just take blood and take lymphocytes, they have so many different cell types that will confuse the story. Okay, so in this case, using the surface antigen that is CD4, you can purify only this fraction that is quite homogeneous. So you can have information on this. Okay, let's see. The results, of course, are results of the same story that you saw before. This is the same as before, no problem. And of course, you can see the data on the browser, but this is very nice to see. But the browser is, I mean, the genome is long, so you cannot explore everything like this. Small windows. You have to find another representation of those results to get information out of your data. And this is this one. So you choose a functional point or whatever. In this case, the easiest way to go is to try to look at the genes. Okay? So the genes, as you know, they have very different lengths, different exon intron composition, different whatever, but they have something in common, that is the transcription start site. So you take all your genes in your genome and align all the genes using the plus one nucleotide. Okay. So you will have the promoter here, and you have the gene body on your right. Okay. Then you take the data that you got from the analysis from all the genes and calculate the frequency at each nucleotide position. Okay? Actually, you don't make at each nucleotide position because it's too heavy from the computational point of view. You take bins. Bins means that you take, for example, 50 base pair bins and go progressively like this and calculate how many reads are there total. So the frequency, total frequency of this. So what you do is the following. Okay, these guys divided the genes in four groups based on their level of expression. They had older data. It's not them. They didn't do the analysis themselves. They had older data in which with affymetric microarrays, the CD4 plus T cells were characterized by transcription. And so they divided in four groups. Highly expressed genes, medium expressed genes, low and silent. Okay, the colors are red, green, blue, and black. Now what you see is there. Okay, so pay attention to this figure, because you will find many, many of those in the course. You see that this zero is the point of alignment that I told you. Okay, so the transcription start site. Go back. This. Okay, this is called plus one when you consider transcription, but of course when you make statistics, zero. Okay? Okay, this is zero. And then you open a window on the right, on the left. These guys open the window of more or less, this is 5,000. Okay, this is 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Okay, so they open the window of 5 kb on the right and 5 kb on the left, each gene, and calculate the frequency. Now I'll show you panel A because it's the most, let's say, intuitive story that you can see on a promoter. This is a ChIP-seq using anti-RNA polymerase 2. Okay? So where do you expect to see the polymerase? Mostly.
Yes.
On the promoter, okay. Usually the polymerase stays there and then starts to make a run. Okay. So look at this, of course the most, the big peak is on the promoter. Good. Then, where do you expect, in which group of the four groups of genes based on the activity you expect to have the highest occupancy in the gene body? Highly expressed genes, right? Because, okay, so look at the story here, and you see that the red trace, that is the highly expressed genes, has a higher level all the through the gene body. This is normal, is expected, and when you look at the silent ones, they are there. So silent, okay, low. Anything. You can be surprised to see some polymerase bound to the promoter also in silent genes. But I don't know if you know already, but we will discuss in a couple of weeks. Many genes are silent, but the polymerase is paused, is stalled on the promoter. So we'll see. Anyway. Good. Now let us to consider another story that is a little less evident than polymerase 2, of course. Okay, that is the 1 ppm. Okay, so this is the dimethylglycine 4. Okay, we know already that the K4 methylated is associated with active genes. So let's look at the distribution now. As you can see here, both medium and high, so this is green and red, they are highly associated with the region, the initial region of the gene, and also with the preceding story. Okay? On the contrary, the low expressed, that is the blue, and the silent genes, they have very low level of occupancy. Okay? And this fits with our knowledge. What it doesn't fit is probably the biphasical story. How can you explain the biphasical graph?
Maybe the starting point of transcription is not quite common for histone modification. I mean, the histone is not there. It's on the promoter or in the transcription site.
So. Has anybody of you another explanation for this biphasic?
There are no histones.
Wow, there are no histones. I mean, this is typical. If you have a promoter, nucleosomes are not there, okay? Because there is the transcriptional apparatus, especially in the active genes. You remember all these factors, that is called a general transcription factor, TFG, T2, the TF2B and blah blah blah, and then the polymerase. Okay, so you have a region that we call a nucleosome free region that is in the promoter. Okay, and this exactly this valley that you see here. Okay, so no histone, no modification, of course. Okay, so you have nucleosomes before and after, of course, and these are heavily changed by this modification. Okay, good. Then you can make the same story on all the modification. This is K4Me3. This is the same that you saw before. Okay, and this is K4Me1, so monomethylation. Again, this is a biphasic story. And then look at this. This is K27Me3. You remember what is K27Me3?
Repressive.
This is a repressive mark. So, as you can see, the colors are inverted. So, the black one is the highest, and the red one is the lowest one. Okay? So, this is 27 monomethylation, that is a kind of dynamic story. Please note that usually the repressive mark is real 3-methylation. You have mono or demethylation, it's not repressive. Then you have K36 here, Me3. That is, this is asymmetrical because the K36 Me3 is associated with the gene body whenever you have transcription. So you see that transcribed genes like red and green, they have good signals of K36 Me3, but only in the right side, that is the gene body. Okay. This is a modification we never talked about, K79. Okay, you can forget it for the moment. This is the repressive mark, K9Me1. Okay, the repressive mark. It's not that easy because usually the real repressive mark is K27, but this monomethylation is sometimes associated with active genes in the body. And these are other modifications. Just let me skip them. And then look at this. This is the last one, the very last one. This is the isoform. It's a histone isoform we talked about last week. Okay? And just to enlarge it, this is H2AZ. That is one of the isoform H2. And as you can see, again, we have a very high signal in the active genes, red and green, in the nucleosomes that just precede the transcription stress site. Okay, so this is a little asymmetrical. Then you have the signal also in the following nucleosomes, and this is biphasic because again you have no histones in between, so no H2AZ. Okay. So there is a phenomenon that is novel because in some sense you only see PTMs. Till now, PTMs are chemical modification. So it's quite easy to understand that you can put and remove quite easily, you remember, with, I don't know, histone acetylase or whatever, or methylase, and it's quite easy to understand how this modification arrives. So why? This means that you have to change a component of the nucleosomes, okay? So this is something that is not worked out completely, how it happens, but it means that in some sense, when you activate a gene like this one, there exists probably some chaperones that takes out the normal H2 isoform and put another one, another isoform. Why they put there? Because H2AZ is less stable. Okay, so it has a reduced interaction with DNA as compared to the normal H2A. So probably when you are in a context of active genes, it's better to have more mobile nucleosomes, than more dynamic nucleosomes than in the heterochromatin. Anyway, so what we learned looking at this paper, this quite old paper, is that promoters have a specific local signature of histone modifications, right? Do you agree with me? Okay. So one of the ways to look at the genome today is also not only look for RNA that is produced by the genes that are active, but also you can explore the genome looking for this particular signature. So wherever you find H2AZ, H3K4, Me3, and whatever, this will be a active promoter. Okay, so we have learned another way to go through the genome and see four active genes without looking to the RNA. Okay. Also, of course, you can also look at the simplest things, so the polymerase occupants. Okay. But anyway, that's a good story. Okay. So what we learned from all these kind of studies, ENCODE studies, big studies, and so on, is the final story. Short message is probably a reductionist view of the story, but anyway. You have, for all these Eastern PTMs, you have a different distribution. You have a gross distribution that are domains, so big parts of the chromatin that carry more or less the same modification, okay? And this is associated to, let's say, large heterochromatic parts of the genome, okay? But you learned already, like the lamin-associated domain or whatever, okay? That are separated from one another by insulators, sequences that usually bound proteins like CTCF, we mentioned already. Okay? So from one part you have this kind of large patches of common modification. And from the other side you have a kind of focused distribution in which you have small functional parts like promoters, enhancers, centromeres, or whatever, that are marked by spatial modification to histones. Okay? So this is the large distribution. You remember the story of the chromosomal territories here. Okay? And you see how, for example, you have compartments of the chromatin that are either completely repressed, like in this case you see this pink shadow here, or completely active, okay, like this green shadowed region here. Okay, so we call them domains, and since they are they include regions of the chromatin that are associated, they are close together, we call them topologically associated domains. So these TADs that you see there means topologically associated domain. And as you can see here, when you see this kind of red hexagon here, these are complex of proteins, mainly CTCF, that make insulators, so they mark the borders of the domain. Okay, we will come to this story again in the future. So just the take-home message is that we have this kind of big domains that are homogeneously active or inactive, and if you look at the histone modification there, you find homogeneous modification in each of these TADs here. Okay. On the other side, we found this kind of specific local modification that actually mark functional parts. Okay. So, for example, in this slide, you see, this is from a review taking in consideration active enhancers, poisoned enhancers, and again, active enhancer from different species and whatever, but just to look at the story, you found enhancers and promoters. Promoters, modification that we saw before in the paper. Okay, so this isoforms, you see that H2AZ is accompanied usually by this other isoform of H3, that is H3.3, and the other one, H3K4-me3. Okay, this marks active promoters. Or, if you look at the enhancers, okay, the enhancers are usually marked by H3K27 acetylated, okay? So you find this specific modification on enhancers, and you will study a lot of this modification with the Professor Kutrup in the last part of the story. And the same substitution of isoform as you find in promoters, so H3.3, H2A.Z, and a slight difference here, because usually on the enhancer the modification to K4H3 is Me1 or Me2, it's not Me3. Okay, so you can make a difference on the story. Okay. So, what about CpG methylation? Then we stop a moment. What about CpG methylation? CpG methylation, as you remember, is 5-methylcytosine here, okay? And these are, just to remember, the enzymes that methylate, and there is phenomenon of demethylation. So it's a dynamic modification. Okay. So how to measure CpG methylation? So we can apply methods to find that, okay? As a single locus level, we can use this tool that are restriction enzymes that are methylation sensitive. So they cut when a sequence is methylated and do not cut when it's not methylated, or vice versa. So you can recognize methylation versus unmethylated C, G sequences, okay? Remember that a cytosine to be methylated has to be followed always by a G. Okay, so that's the story. And the other method is a bisulfite conversion. When you treat DNA with bisulfite, sodium bisulfite, what you do is that you increase spontaneous deamination. Deamination means that you lose this amine here. Okay, you lose. Actually, it's a spontaneous reaction. Just if you put bisulfite, you make everything immediately. Okay, and if you deamine here, you get an oxygen in place. What is the base in which you have methyl O and O and what is it? Hello, biologists. If you have a DNA base in which you have oxygen, okay, and then oxygen here, okay, in place of the amino group, and then you have a methyl group here, what is? Is T. Thymine, okay? So you change it from C to T, and this is a spontaneous reaction, actually. So one of the analyses that, of course, if you have it's true, you have a U.
Yes.
You were right, a U, and then you convert in C by PCR, in T by PCR, of course. Okay, so you have a C converted to the U, and then if you make a PCR, you get a T. And on the contrary, when you have methyl C, now this is the confusion to me, because the cytosine is converted to uracil, but the methyl cytosine is not a T, okay? It's not converted by bisulfite, so you can get this one. So finally, when you have a situation like this one, okay, and you make bisulfite, this CGCG sequence is retained, okay? Otherwise, if you have unmethylated sequence, you will convert to TGTG. So if you have an enzyme like this guy here, BSTU1, that actually cuts CGCG, you have cutting here, you don't have cutting here. So you can detect by PCR and then restriction you can distinguish methylated versus non-methylated stories. So it is possible to convert to genome-wide studies. Yes, actually we have two approaches. The first approach is to make an immunoprecipitation, exactly as you do with CHIP. Okay, so you make immunoprecipitation. The big difference is that you don't use chromatin, but you use directly DNA. Okay, so you take your cells, you extract DNA, not chromatin. Okay. Then you make fragments by sonication, and then finally you put an antibody against 5-methylcytosine. This will pick up all the fragments which contain methylated cytosine, okay? And then you sequence. Okay? Another version of the story is that another kind of immunoprecipitation is not using antibodies, but using MBD. MBD stands for methyl DNA binding domain that is present in many proteins that are being used to fuse with a tag to be able to immunoprecipitate. But anyway, it's the same idea, I mean. Okay? And then you can either use microarrays in the first years or NGS of this. Okay? And the second approach is to bisulfite convert all the DNA. So you take all the DNA, you convert bisulfite, then fragment and make NGS, whole genome sequences. Okay? So what is the pros and cons of the two technologies? Okay, this is a problem that you cannot distinguish hypomethylated fragment from low methylated fragments. I mean, it's enough to have one methylation that the antibody will pick up it. Okay, so you cannot distinguish. And in the second approach, the problem is that this is enormously difficult because when you make, okay, so you DNA purify, fragment, bisulfite conversion, adapter ligation, library, and sequencing, the problem is that all these sequences here are, whenever you have cytosine, you have converted in T. So you cannot map these reads on the genome. The genome is C, it's not T. Can you follow me? I say that again. Okay, so you have made a bisulfite conversion of DNA. Okay, so you change it C to T. Unmethylated C to T. Okay, right? Then you have reads, because you make NGS sequences, you have short reads. Okay? In all the positions in which you have unmethylated C, you have a T now. And how can you map on the genome? The genome has C, it's not T. So it makes a real big problem for bioinformatic guys to map this kind of story, because they have to make different reference genomes in which all the possible positions are changed to T, and then try to compare the reads to it. So, to make the story short, this kind of approach requires an enormous depth of sequence. So you have to sequence to have an enormous number of reads to be able to map everything. But they actually did it. Okay. In the other version, so the methylation, you can just take with an antibody the fragments that are methylated, and then you can either go to a microarrays with green and red, or take these fragments and go to NGS. Okay. This is a little easier to go to do, but as I told you, the problem is that it doesn't detect difference in the density of the conversion. Okay, so doing this kind of stories, CpG hypermethylation was observed mainly at heterochromatic and inactive regions, and this we knew already, so it's nothing really new from the genomic point of view. But where, if you look at the small focused hypermethylation. The problem is that, as I told you before, the C, the amination is actually a spontaneous reaction. Okay, so it happens in our cells every day at a very high rate. Fortunately, we have a repair system, as you probably remember from the first course. Okay, so usually when you have a conversion, the system repairs and put back a C and whatever. But of course, if you look this from an evolutionary scale point of view, it happens that actually the C is sometimes is converted to T and the repair doesn't work. So you have a high rate of mutation from C to T. And what happens in the genomes is that you usually see that the percentage of C is a little less than expected and the percentage of T is a little higher than expected. Okay, so this is unbalanced due to this problem. While in our genome and also in the other genomes exist regions in which this C is maintained. Why? Because usually when you have regions that are in some way coupled to transcription, like in promoters or in gene body and so on and so, there is a system of repair that is tightly coupled with transcription. In other terms, wherever you have transcription, you have higher level of repair. So this means that the regions that are functionally important for transcription did not lose all the C as compared to the other the genome. So these are called islands, CG islands. Okay, and usually you find CG islands, for example, in promoters and in other active functional regions of the genome. Okay, this is the story. So an important fraction of human genes are associated to this CPG island, especially usually constitutive expressed genes or also called housekeeping genes, so the genes that are expressed in all cell types, constitutive way. Okay, so this is probably the half of the lesson, so we have to have a coffee. I will reopen. So, may I have your attention, please? Change tone. Okay. So, coming back to the lesson. Now, in the second part of today, that is very short because it's very late, we start to go through your textbook, okay? Since has anybody of you read at least the first initial part of the campus reviews?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah? A little bit? Yeah. No? Not really? Quelli che guardano tutti che non Do it, please, do it. It's very clear. And you will understand everything very neatly if you read a little bit, at least the first paragraph, okay? So, what is the subject of this review? Is this what happens to chromatin organization during cell division? Because this is an important point, because we have just discussed that we have either domain organization or very local organization of chromatin. But then when the cell enters mitosis, everything is subverted, of course. The chromosomes, as you remember, first of all, they are replicated. So you make two molecules of DNA, right? And second, they are compacted to make chromosomes as everybody knows them. And then they're separated, and then the nuclei are reorganized again. So we have two ways, actually. We have two ways. Either you remake from the beginning the differentiation process, Okay? So you have completely undifferentiated chromatin, and you go through the definition of the chromatin, blah, 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 to reach the same status as the mother cell. Okay? Or you have some marks, some flags here and there in the chromosomes saying, remember that when you make again the nuclei and the interface nuclei, this will be a heterochromatic part, this will be a euchromatic part, this will be a promoter, this will be a... Okay, so there are two choices, and of course it's a kind of rhetorical, sorry, because of course when the cell divide, you don't make all the developmental story again. Okay, so this is what we call epigenetics. Okay, so there are flags around that are kept in some way during cell division, during DNA replication, that will establish the same chromatin situation that was in the mother cell. Okay? So this is because usually when an epithelial cell divides, it makes two epithelial cells, daughter cells, okay? And not two neurons or two whatever, okay? So it's a kind of keeping the differentiation. Of course, this is not always true, because you can have, as you know from cell biology, you can have either what we call symmetrical division, right? In which the two cells that are formed from the mother cells are same, okay? Or you can have a phenomenon of asymmetric division, in which you divide a cell and one become something and the other one another type. This is typical, for example, of stem cells, you remember, okay? Stem cells, very often they go through precursor plus stem cell. So it's a kind of maintenance of itself plus something that will differentiate. Okay? Or you can have differentiation during division. So you differentiate and you make two different cell types. So the first two cases here that you see up and the middle, something happens that is called the establishment of chromatin domains, okay? So you have a kind of reprogramming of the chromatin. While in this case here down, you have a maintenance. So what was written is kept as such. So this is your textbook, and in the textbook exactly talks about this problem. And also in the final part, actually, it talks of another problem that is very modern, that is what is called transgenerational inheritance. Okay? I see that you are perplexed about it, because it's something that is not usually very popular. But it means that sometimes you have acquired characters, not genetic characters. Genetic character we know very well that are transmitted from mother, father, to the child. But I mean something that is acquired over genetics, so epigenetics, that is transmitted to the child. Okay, this is called transgenetical inheritance. And is a very largely debated question, because it's very difficult. If you read one of the boxes in the review, there is a yellow box that talks about transgenetic inheritance. And they say it's very debated, because there are so many confounding factors. Okay, for example, you say, okay, if the father drinks alcohol, I mean, is a drinker, okay, the child will have some disturbances in the domain of chromatin or something epigenetic, but this actually you cannot demonstrate if you don't have a molecular definition of something like a methylation in something, and then you find in the father in the spermatocyte, and then you find in the child. You cannot say that it's a direct, because it may well happen that the fact that the father drinks has some social effect on the mother, okay? And the mother actually has the child inside for a long time. So you cannot distinguish, can you follow my reasoning? You cannot distinguish a molecular effect from a social or relation or also, let's say, environmental effect on the mother. It's very difficult. Especially because you cannot only work on animals, of course, because you have to make all this kind of molecular determination, different stages, okay? And of course, animals sometimes have phenotypes that are not so easy to understand, like, for example, psychological disturbances or whatever. It's more easy to see on humans than in mouse. And so, I mean, the story is complex, but it's very interesting. Anyway, let's take to the mitosis, cellular mitosis, that is easier to study for the moment, okay? So, whenever you have mechanisms guiding the transmission of epigenetic memory, so this is a definition, whatever is transmitted mitotically, we call it epigenetic memory, all right? And mitotically inheritable means that you have a transmission also during the mitosis, okay? And so you have to examine what happens during the replication of DNA, and especially with nucleosomes, okay? That what happens during the replication fork advancement, okay? And then finally, this transgenerational you will see next week, okay? So please take a look of this glossary that is the other yellow box in the review, because it's very important, because sometimes we find terms that we are not completely sure what they mean. Okay, so epigenetic inheritance, the inheritance of a phenotype in a manner that is independent of the DNA sequence and that remains self-perpetuating in the absence of the initial stimulus that caused the phenotype in the parental cell or organism. And this is also very important. Okay, so let's see the first paragraph, the second after the introduction, of course. And so this is concerns the dismantling and restoring chromatin throughout DNA replication. And this, of course, is something very important, because when you replicate, something has to happen to the DNA itself and to chromatin, so to nucleosomes, right? So the first one is to DNA. And actually, what happens to the DNA, to the methylation of DNA, is the first thing that we knew since now 50 years at least. So it's a very old story, okay? We discussed it already during last lesson, okay? Whenever you have, we will see that. Whenever you have DNA methylated, you will keep this kind of methylation in the daughter DNA. Okay, so you remember that DNA replication in humans starts from origins that are marked by proteins, okay? So you have different origins. There is no real sequence for initiation in DNA. There are several complexes of protein that binds successively to some region, and then the fork will start. You remember how a fork is made? Probably not. I remind you how a fork is made. You have, of course, primase, you remember, and you have to make small RNA to prime the synthesis. I'm looking at your eyes. If you remember that story. Then you have the polymerase, of course. Then you have to helicase, right? This MCM complex is the helicase. So what actually folds the two strands. And when you go, if the forks move ahead, of course you have supercoiling in front of you, so you have to have a topoisomerase in the front to remove this supercoiling. It's a kind of complex story. Then you have this PCNH. You remember what are PCNH? Clumps they actually close around the DNA in order not to make the all the machinery dissociated. This is very important because, as you remember, on the leading strand, you remember you have a leading and a lagging strands. Okay, the leading strands will be replicated continuously, so the apparatus must stay there. Okay, so this is the region where you have this PCNA clamp over there. And then you have other proteins that are, for example, in the on the other filaments, you have RNase H that removes the RNA primers from the Okazaki fragments. You remember this Okazaki fragment story over there? Then you have other enzymes, the DNA ligase, of course, to join all the fragments, Okazaki, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you have a lot of proteins over there. But what usually don't see in a replication slide, okay, on the books or whatever, is what happened to nucleosomes. Because always you look at the DNA, okay, the story is already quite complicated with the DNA. So usually in the books you remove the nucleosomes. Don't think about nucleosomes. But actually nucleosomes are there, and so it's a complicated story. Okay, let's look again, from the DNA methylation we talked already, but just to remember well. So whenever you have a situation in which you may have CG that are not methylated, okay, or CG couples that are methylated, okay. So this is the parental DNA. When you go through DNA replication, of course, on the daughter strand, you don't incorporate methyl cytosine, you incorporate normal cytosine, okay. So you will have heme-methylated sites, like this one. Okay, so this situation is recognized by this DNMT1. That is the DNA methyltransferase 1, and this will methylate the other sites in the other filament. Okay, but if you have unmethylated site, it will stay like this. So no action on the DNA. It's a biochemist will say that this DNMT1 is a methylation-dependent DNA methylase. Okay, good. So this is the first mechanism. So whenever you have stretches of islands that are hypermethylated, you will exactly copy in the same way if you have symmetrical division. Okay, if no reprogramming event occurs, of course. Okay, so this is the first, and then what happens to nucleosomes? That this is the same story as before. It's simplified, because if I put all the proteins, we cannot understand anything. Okay, but of course, just to focus, this is the helicase, okay? So if you go back to the other design, this is the MCM helicase we have there, okay? And this is the helicase, okay? And this is so you have to imagine the DNA polymerase and whatever here, and it moves like this, okay? So in front of the moving fork, you will find normal nucleosomes, right? So these nucleosomes will have marks of this tail with the red dots means that you have, for example, methylation or whatever on the histones. Okay. Good. Now the problem that is discussed in your review is what happens to these nucleosomes. Of course, they are dismantled because otherwise you cannot replicate DNA. Okay. But then what happens? Okay, so there was a kind of very big study on the story especially using labeling. So they label amino acid for short periods of time and then during replication to see where they were conserved or not. And what we saw is that actually what is actually kept together is the H3A4 tetramer. So this guy here, that is the H3, H4 tetramer, stays together, so it's not dismantled. There was a whole theory about the action of one of these proteins, that is SF1, that was also dismantling in two dimers, but it actually has been abandoned today. So the recent studies show that actually whenever you the forks arise to the nucleosomes, what it does is to take out H2A, H2B dimer, that is this gray dish that you see here. So there is a chaperone that is called FACT that has is connected protein-protein interaction with this helicase. And actually when it reaches the nucleosome, it will take out the dimers, H2A, H2B, okay? But leaving the tetramer intact, okay? So this is the reason why we think that actually this tetramer with its PTM modification is the main object of epigenetic inheritance. Okay, because it's kept as such, it's not modified. Then when the two novel DNA are synthesized, like this and this, of course you need to deposit again nucleosomes. Okay? And this is a very early event, because people looking for incorporating, labeled precursors of nucleotides, in order to distinguish newly synthesized DNA from the older one, have looked at the texture. There is a very small piece of DNA that is nucleosome-free after the fork, not more than 200 to 250 nucleotides. So as soon as a length compatible to make a nucleosome is made, the nucleosome jumps over it. So you make nucleosome again, okay? And what we see is that usually you have this older tetramer coming from the front of the fork are distributed randomly on the two novel DNA. Okay? So if, for example, you have labeled the cell before, the mitosis, all these histones are labeled. Okay? So at this point you can remove the label, go through the mitosis, then stop for a little bit, and look for the novel nucleosomes, and you find half the label in both the molecules. So this means that they are distributed randomly on the two daughter DNA molecules. Okay? Can you follow? Good. So, of course, you need to have novel nucleosomes, because we always talk about replication of DNA, but you have to replicate everything. So during the cell cycle phase that is preceding the mitosis, okay, following mitosis, sorry, you have to make histones. And you make a lot of histones, and actually this guy here, S1, is the one that is taking the novel histones from the cytoplasm and it brings to the nucleus, and it will deliver dimers H3, H4 to the calf. Calf is the real mount, real chaperone mounting the novel nucleosomes. And of course, some of these nucleosomes are novel, so they are composed of novel histones coming from the cytoplasm. The only modification they have is acetylation to H4. So the histone H4 is acetylated in the cytoplasm and will give already acetylated to the nucleus. Okay? But other modifications are not present in these novel nucleosomes. Okay? And other nucleosomes, on the contrary, they are older nucleosomes, older histones coming from here. Okay? So it's a kind of random distribution, novel and older. Okay. So, what I have to say? Okay, this is just the legend for the figures, octamer, tetramer, and the diamonds. So you can interpret what happened. So they actually these histones are redistributed. So what is the final story is that you have a kind of half mark. Okay, there are two or three comments to make. Is that okay? First of all, that there are special isoforms of the histones that are coming from the cytoplasm. So when you have novel nucleosomes, usually you incorporate these isoforms of H3 that are called the replication-dependent H3 isoforms. Okay, and this third one is incorporated only post-transcriptionally. You remember you found H3.3 at the analysis. So this factor is the one that brings the histones to the nucleus, okay? And this S1 has been also seen to interact with the replicative clamp loader, that is the protein which puts the PCNA on the complex, and interacts also with the MCM subunits of replicative helicase. So actually it goes directly to the fork. And finally, it will deliver the histones to CAF1. And then the trimers are transferred to DNA. The H2, HB are the final story when the trimer is already on the DNA. Okay, so that's the final. So I told you that there was two models for a long time. So if you find all the reviews or in the books especially, you still find these two models, the splitting model and the random tetramer model. So following the splitting model, some authors in the past thought that SH1 may split the tetramer in two, so making two dimers. And these authors actually proposed that there were these dimers going randomly to the assembly of novel nucleosomes. But actually, as I told you, the latter now is favored. So the random tetramer, that is the model that we described before, is favored. Especially since PTMs are not symmetrical in the two half tetramers. This is something novel to you? Whereas the PTMs are indeed conserved equally after replication in the two daughter chromatin molecules. Can you rationalize this story here? Okay, the nucleosome is formed by two molecules of H3, two molecules of H4, and blah blah. Okay, so whenever we talk about PTMs, we always say, okay, K27, H3 K27 is methylated, but which one? There are two of those in a nucleosome. So either you can have symmetrical modification that is the same, or you may have asymmetrical modification. And actually, we saw, always by very sophisticated experiments and analysis of histones, that many times these PTMs are non-symmetrical in the two copies of the histones. Okay? So this means that if you had a dismantling of the tetramer and then remounting, you will have an even distribution of this asymmetrical modification, while the studies demonstrated that you have always the same story. So if you find a modification asymmetric in the parental, it's asymmetric also in the daughter. Okay, so that's it. Good, so this is the just a particular of this fact, that is the histone chaperone, that is the one that removes the H2A, H2B dimers, okay? And actually it has been mapped a strict connection of fact chaperone with the helicase. Helicase is formed by these MCM proteins, and in the review you see that MCM mutants that are unable to interact with this histones here, okay, show the effect in telomeric heterochromatin. And I just showed this slide to you to explain what is telomeric heterochromatin story. Do you know something about telomeric chromatin? No, never heard. Say yes or no, please? Never. Okay. This is a very old story on East, in which as you know, telomeres and centromeres are constitutively heterochromatic, right? In the East, the telomeric chromatin is formed by different proteins than usual. It's not for a long tract, it's not histone. But there is a protein that is called RAP1 that covers the telomere. And then this RAP1 interacts with a series of proteins that are called sirtuins. And these also polymerize a little bit on the telomere. Okay? And this diffuse, when this part reaches the normal chromatin, this heterochromatization diffuses inside for a while, okay? But if you make this replication defective mutant of MCM, you have no extension of the telomeres. And this demonstrates that to make chromatin, you need this interaction between MCM component of the helicase and the FACT and the H2HPD dimer. Anyway, that's the reason why they mention this kind of story in the review. Okay. Why? Okay, so you have a kind of... Let's take the final story, then we stop. So, the final story is that, of course, if you have this kind of redistribution, okay, on the two daughter molecules, in terms of PTMs, so in terms of modification, what happens is that they are diluted, right? Can you follow me? So, for example, if you had all the nucleosome with a specific methylation, H3K27 methylated, you will have only half of the new that are methylated, okay? So the story is how the domain, the two novel daughter domain, acquire back all the modification as in the mother. And this is because there are this copying mechanism. There is a mechanism of copy. So if you have a pre-existing methylation, you will reproduce the same methylation. If you have acetylation, you will reproduce acetylation on the novel nucleosome and whatever. And this is why there are protein complexes that contain writer, readers, and derisers all together. Okay, and this is very good exemplified by two cases. One is the polycomplex repressor, and the other one is this HP1 sub-39 protein. I show you the model. The model is very easy. So imagine that you have, this is a nucleosome with a PTM, that is the red dot. You have a complex of protein that contains together the PTM binding protein, so the protein recognizes this modification, and the enzymes that carry on the modification. So if you have an unmodified nucleosome close to it, it will be modified also. Okay, so this is the model, really very, very easy. So this model comes from older studies in East, in Fission East, in which you see that people found that the HP1, heterochromatic protein 1, is the protein binding this modification, H3K9 methylation. Okay. Actually travels together with the SUV39H1, that is a methyl transferase for the same position. Okay. So wherever you find these two guys together, you will have spreading, we say spreading of the chromatin mark. The same is in mammals, okay, with different names and components, but I showed you the story just because this is the first in East shown several years ago. Actually, this complex also contains different enzymes, like for example this histone deacetylase, of course. If you have to make a repressive mark, you also have to remove active marks, right? So they travel together. And the second important complex example of this coping mechanism is constituted by this polycomb repressive complex too. This is a very important protein in the determination of repressive marks in the chromosomes, in mammals as well, and other organisms like, actually it has been studied a lot in Drosophila, but it's more or less the same in human. And this is a complex that contains different proteins which have different activities. The EED is the protein which recognizes the modification, H3K27M3, all right? And the complex contains this IZH2 proteins, which are set domain. Set domain is typical of the methyl transferases. It's the catalytic domain of all the methyl transferases. And this will introduce novel methylation to the adjacent nucleosomes. This complex also contains different proteins like SUS12, BP4, and it is quite important because actually you have a model in which you may have different anchors to the story. So the complex is this one, and it can be recruited to the chromosome not only by this H3K27 methylation, but also with different stories. For example, by binding to the DNA with this component that is called AABP2, or with this JARID2 complex that is actually binding all the region of DNA that are GC rich, or this other guy that is a histone binding protein. Okay, so I mean, every time you have a kind of modification on the DNA or chromosome itself that is linked to the repressive state, the PCR complex can land there and complete the methylation of the K27. Okay, so you have another complex of the same group, polycomb complex PRC1, that is a little different from the other one. It also binds to the same modification, so it has a module that binds to the same K27 3-methylated, but has a different activity. So you see there, it brings about monoubiquitination of H2A in position K119, and this is required for chromatin compaction. Okay, so this is the story. Good, last thing, and then we say bye-bye to tomorrow, not tomorrow, Wednesday, is that this kind of histone marks that are propagated from the original ones are not immediate, okay? People always with this kind of labeling studies try to look whether it was directly connected to the S phase when you have replication of DNA, okay? Or if it is a little delayed in respect to that. And as you can see, you have different stories. So when you look, this is G1 phase of the cell cycle, this is S phase, when you have division, of course, and this is G2M, and this is G1. So when you go to the S phase, not all the complexes that you find are actually linked to it. You find in this phase, you find the complex that I told you, CAF1, PCNA, and whatever, and some of the protein methyl transferases that you needed. But many of them, for example, this HP1 SUV that we described before, it actually happens, as you can see, in the passage of G2, beta phase, and then G1. Also in G1, you still see some spreading of this modification. So it's a kind of slow recovery of the chromatin phase. And this is compatible with the fact that, of course, during metaphases, the chromosomes are still compacted, okay? So probably you cannot make this exactly the same modification during compaction. You need to reach the end of metaphase and then G1. G1 means that you get back the interphase chromosome. And at this point, you recover all the modification. Also PRC1, PRC2 complex act in this, let's say, restoring phase of the interface nuclei. Okay? So this is the last question that we have today. You can read everything better than I did in your review. And then, that's it for today. Ciao. Molto faticosa.